And now, a man who needs no introduction, but I will introduce Dan Mortensen, who has put this meeting together and had the concept of filling this room with toys and finding out what we could find out about networks. So,
all right. Cable. All right, thank you. So thank you all for coming. I'm going to change slides here in a second to go over to Steve. So if you want to write a menu item down, you should do that quickly because we won't see that again. The course of the day will be somewhat flexible. I've got kind of an order of what we're going to do. The first part will be Steve Lampen talking about cable, which he knows so well. The second part will be a demonstration and discussion of connectors and terminating the cables that Kurt Denke will show us and lead. The third part will be measurement that Kurt and Mac Perkins and Rick Rodriguez will talk about and show. The fourth part will be messing around with the consoles and cables there. There will be a break around 12:30 or so for lunch, and you can either stay here and order the takeout like I've been saying, or if you brought something you can eat it, or you can go somewhere and grab something, or you can just stay and not eat, which is probably what I'll do because I don't eat lunch. And then we'll get into wherever we stopped and didn't finish, we'll just continue, and we'll wrap it up around 4:30 or 5 or something. To get all this stuff out of here. This is not a prepared presentation, so excuse the fluffs and confusion that will inevitably occur, but I think it's going to be an interesting time. This event was triggered by an event where I set up my sound systems and was able to unintentionally disrupt the signal on the CAT cable by pulling it. And that was confusing because I didn't think that was possible. And I've looked into it and found that this subject is very large and not many people, if anybody, knows all of the parts of it. Everybody that I've talked to knows some of it, but they don't know the full thing. So I thought it would be great to get together as a group and share information. So I'm hoping that it will be completely a presentation, but that you will contribute if you have something that you know about or an experience that you've had, that you will throw it in as appropriate during the course of the day. I'm going to be somewhat aggressive about limiting the conversation and directing it. We don't want to go off on a half-hour tangent, but I'll tell you, every time I've talked with any of these guys about this subject, we've talked for an hour and have not scratched the surface, so it's going to be a full day, I think. And with that done, I'm going to change the projector over to Steve. Well, first of all, are there any questions before we continue? Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Steve, and let's get your projector. I think this is you.
That was it, yeah.
Yep, okay.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me here. I'm delighted always to be in the Northwest. In fact, it seems like I never leave. I mean, Kurt and I, he's my customer now, and we're talking all the time. So it's like, and there's so many other people I know. A lot of you already know me, and I kind of travel around. I'm never at home. I just got back from the Nordic countries last week, actually, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Finland. In the middle of that, I went to Dubai, which they didn't tell me wasn't close to Finland. I thought, no, it was a long way off, but that's the only way it fit together. Oh, is that what it is? No, wait, I did Denmark as well. But and so the point is, I brought back some cables with me from Europe, which don't exist here yet, but you can look at them and slather and drool at them. And eventually they might be available because we're trying to internationalize our cables so that everybody gets everything, which is a radical new idea for us, So I wish us luck with that. But I can show you what they have that you don't have, for instance. So what I'm going to talk about here, as you can see, I just actually changed the title of this to the history of category cables, because if you don't know where you've come from, then you don't know where you're going. And in fact, I actually start here with the history of Ethernet, but there's a lot of history before that. in terms of understanding twisted pairs, in terms of understanding data. I mean, that's the thing. This could be a five-hour presentation, and I have 40 minutes, so I'll do what I can here. So let me just start with these guys. This is really the history of Ethernet, which is kind of what we're talking about. I mean, you know, the Ethernet and twisted pairs and coax and data are all separate things. Some people put them all together and assume they're kind of together, but they're not at all. And for instance, Ethernet really started with that guy on the left, Norm Abramson, who back in the late 60s was given a job of wiring up the Hawaiian Islands, which sounded like a really interesting project, especially when he didn't have any money to do it, like all good projects. And so what he did was put ads in the papers at major universities like MIT and UC Berkeley and places like that, saying, free Hawaiian vacation, we'll fly you out here if you're a graduate student in computer science. Now, the interesting thing is, in the late 60s, the first master's degree in computer science was 1968. So, I mean, this is just at that point when there were a few kids who were figuring out that there might be something interesting here. One of them was Bob Metcalf, who was at MIT at the time, and he answered this ad and they flew him out. And the interesting thing was they had already begun to wire up the Hawaiian Islands. Now, the problem with the islands is the fact that they are the tallest mountains on Earth, most of which is underwater. So to get from this island to the island you can see over there, you have to go down 30,000 feet and back up 30,000 feet, which is virtually impossible to do and super expensive. And so Norm hit on the idea of doing it by radio. That's the whole thing, doing data on radio at the time. Wireless was considered groundbreaking from that standpoint. And so he had all the islands all transmitting, and the problem, of course, is when they're all transmitting, nobody gets anything through because there are all these collisions. And into this fray came Bob Metcalf, who had just taken a course in the statistical analysis of computer data, which sounds like the craziest thing in the 60s. Who would take that course, you know? Probably three kids in the class. But it was exactly what he needed to solve this problem of the Hawaiian Islands. By the time he left, he had that network up to 85% efficiency, because what it would do is it would transmit, then if there was a collision, they would stop, they would pick an average time to retransmit, and then they wouldn't hit each other the second time around, and you would collect all your data. Oh, that's another thing that Norm Abramson invented, was chopping the data into words, 8-bit words. That was his invention. And so the point is, you take these words and put them in the correct order, because they all have addresses, and then you can read a line of data. And this was all his invention, and they were just doing this by the seat of their pants, as you can imagine. So Bob Metcalf went back to MIT, got his doctorate. He's Dr. Bob Metcalf. I actually had dinner with him a few months ago, which is interesting, talking about new things coming in Ethernet, like Ethernet AVB, which I don't know if we'll get today, but if you want to talk about it, I'll be glad to. And he didn't even know what that was. So lest you think that you're behind the eight ball and not ahead of it, here's a guy who invented Ethernet who didn't even know what's happening to Ethernet today. So, but what happened was he and another guy, Dave Boggs, were hired by Xerox, you know, the copy people, and they thought that they were going to be the next IBM, which is a long story in itself, because Chester Carlson had originally tried to interest IBM in buying Xerox and creating that. And Tom Watson Jr. said, well, making copies of documents can't be a feasible business by itself, and turned him down. So this is payback time, where Chester Carlson comes back and tries to become the next IBM. And so he hired these guys, Bob Metcalf and Dave Boggs, to create the operating system. And he had, of course, Bob Metcalf, all this experience with, you know, putting stuff into words and collisions and retransmission and all this stuff. And they literally put it all together. And the funny thing is they kept this joke name, the joke name that they called in Hawaii. That's really AlohaNet was the name of the network. But this system, this operating system, they called it Ethernet because it was going through the ether, you know, by radio. That's a joke. And it's a joke that has stuck with us to this very day. It's still a joke. Ethernet, you know, there's nothing about the ether in any of this stuff. So the whole point is, on this date, May 23rd, 1973, they sent a whole megabit of data across their lab at the Xerox Research Center. And this was on coax, by the way. And all this stuff started out on coax. In fact, the first computers were all on coax. Nobody ever thought about twisted pairs as being a medium that you could use for data. And all these coaxes, like thick net and thin net, we still make. They're still in the Belden catalog. We still sell them. Don't ask me who's buying them. That I have no idea. But the point is, we still make these, thick net, thin net. You might even, anybody install some of these? Weird stuff. Yeah, see? Okay, ancient guy over here. Yeah. With vampire taps, we actually mark on the thick net cable where you put the vampire tap and you screw it down, and it pushes the thing through to the center conductor to make the contact, if you can believe that. And then you have drop cables, which are the smaller stuff, the thin net. And then people found out, hey, you can use any 50-ohm coax for this. So they started having cheap net and then crap net. And, you know, it's like, and they all kind of worked, you know, some better than others. And pretty much like the twisted pairs today. So, and then there's all these variations, ArcNet and things like that. And then along comes IBM. Oh, and by the way, I should say also that at one point Xerox gave up on their bid to be the next giant computer company. And if you see one of their computers that's in the museum now, because they pretty much gave up and fired these two guys. And the whole idea of Ethernet, yes? Oh, no question about it. Oh, there are all sorts of astounding things that they let go by, no question. The funny thing is the one thing that Xerox kept was the name Ethernet. They still own that word. What they're going to do with it, it's kind of too late to sue people about it, but you know, you never know. So along comes IBM after this and says, you know, we need to, first of all, create a research center, which they did, the Almaden Research Center. It's still there in San Jose, not far from where I live in San Francisco. I've been there. And those scientist brainiacs, I mean, when you have a think tank, like this is the first real think tank, how can you tell when they're working, you know? I mean, it looks like the same when they're not working, you know? It's just like they're thinking, you know? And I guess it's when they produce stuff at the end of the day. And one of the ideas they said is, you know, we really should revisit this idea of twisted pairs carrying data. Because twisted pairs will do one thing that coax will never do, and that is reject noise when it's hooked up as a balanced line. Now, I'll tell you, I could go from here into a one-hour discussion about balanced lines and how those work. Something that audio people work as well. It's all the same stuff. But now we're talking about balanced lines running megahertz of bandwidth. And the point is, so these pairs will reject noise, which coaxes won't do. And there are lots of other advantages as well, some of which are size and things like that, and cost. And so they brought out called IBM Type 1, which was the first twisted pair. It was a foil-shielded twisted pair, two pairs in a cable. And of course, designed by engineers, not designed by installers. This is, you know, the closest to perfection they could come. Well, the ideal impedance, for instance, is 150 ohms. If you think about this in coax, the lowest loss is 75 ohms, and 275s is 150 ohms. You follow this? So they brought out 150 ohm twisted pairs, two in a cable. This thing was the size of a garden hose. I mean, it's huge, you know? The perfect example of a cable designed by engineers who would never have to install any, right? Because it was impossible to install. But boy, did it work well. It had super low capacitance. I mean, I have little specs down there of how good it is. And the whole point is, so what they did was prove that you could run data down twisted pairs. That was given. And they also brought out IBM Type 1A and Type 2. 1A actually expanded the bandwidth to 400 megahertz. On a twisted pair, which at the time they started at 16 and suddenly went to 400. Oh my God, this is crazy talk. 400 megahertz? And the reason they're doing that is to do this new thing called video to the desktop. Oh my God, the people are going to actually look at videos on their computers. Oh, this is just the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know, which shows you how long ago this was. So they have proved that twisted pairs will carry data, but clearly these cables are way too big. Now, they had a very cool connector on it, a hermaphroditic connector, you know, male and female. You couldn't put the wrong one on the cable because they all fit together. And the last major building to have IBM Type 1 put in it was Sears Tower when that was built in Chicago, okay? That gives you kind of an idea of the time. So the whole point is they had proved twisted pairs would work, but a lot of people came and said, look, I have these telephone cables here. Those have twisted pairs. Why can't I use those? Well, they're not good enough, you know? We have to make them better. We have to fix the pair. And plus they said, well, all those IBM things, those are all shielded pairs. Do we really have to have shields on them? Well, not really. I mean, they'll work fine without shields. And believe me, there's another hour discussion right there of shields and not shields. you know, which I'd be glad to have. Invite me back. I'll tell you all about that stuff. But the whole point is, people started to make twisted pairs for data. And the problem is, it was all over the map in terms of the quality. You know, some were great, some were horrible, and some were in between. And so how do you know what you're getting? And so one company, Anixter, you probably know who they are, a distributor, finally decided, screw this, we're just going to measure everybody and put them in some kind of order, which they called levels. They still have a level program, although they don't use it very much anymore. But the point is, so they had level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and it said something about the quality of the performance of the cables. Now, this idea really hit on this committee, which was just formed at the time, the Electronic Industry Association, the Telecommunication Industry Association, and 568 is the number of the committee. And so they were given the job, hey, let's do this twisted pair for data thing. Let's create some standards. Now, we can't use the word levels because they already took levels for Anixter. Let's call it categories. And that's what they came out with categories. Now, first they said category one is any twisted pair that's out there. In other words, they're not reinventing anything. They're just saying, you got a twisted pair, we'll call that category one. Now, if you have a twisted pair that's intended for data, like all these pairs that they were playing with at the time, we'll call that category two. But the first one that they actually designed by themselves and said, here's a spec sheet, here's the requirements, here's crosstalk, here's attenuation, and all this stuff that you have to meet, that was category three. That was the first one that they actually invented as a committee, so to speak. And which is why category three is still with us. Now, it's interesting that it's still with us, not because of something they did, but because the FCC, once they got wind of this, said, wait a minute, all the stuff that's coming into people's homes now, well, some of it's the telephone, but a lot of it's now data. And we're worried about emissions, you know, and signals interfering with each other. That's a big deal, you know, part 15 and all that. And so they said, well, let's stipulate that all the wiring going into the people's houses has to be category three or higher, which is why category three would have long ago gone and you would never have seen it, except they made it the standard for all the phone wiring in the US. The funny thing is now you look at the phone wiring they put into your new house, it's all 5 or 5E or something, because that's just cheap as cheap now. I'm not even sure if you can find category three, even though it's still part of the spec, and they cannot drop it because the FCC is using it. Now, that's not the same for category four, which went up to a blistering 20 megahertz of bandwidth, because as soon as they brought category five out, which is 100 megahertz, suddenly that was the death knell for category four. And that's what's happening all the way along, is that as we go along and we have something better, they drop something down below, so they don't have too many standards to choose from. You know, that gets really confusing. But Cat 5 really was the thing that really opened the door. 100 megahertz bandwidth, 100 megabits of data rate, that's a lot on a twisted pair cable. And I mean, here's a category 5E, which is pretty close to the same thing. The difference between 5 and 5E is that 5E is intended to run the data on all four pairs simultaneously, instead of one pair transmit and one pair receive, which it's been until this point. Suddenly all four pairs are running both directions at the same time, something called duplex mode. And unless you think that's insane, that's what your telephone already does, is duplex mode. You have two wires, you talk and receive at the same time, you know, on those two wires. Well, they're doing the same thing only at 100 megabits and 100 megahertz bandwidth. So the whole point is, 5E is tested differently than Cat 5 because all four pairs are being used, and things like the delivery of the signals on the four pairs is now critical, something called delay skew, which didn't exist before. You had one pair go and one pair come and nobody cared when they got there. Now suddenly it's important, and the impedance of the pairs, something called return loss, is now spec'd. I mean, there are four or five other things that are in the 5E spec that weren't in the 5 spec. So it's not exactly a different cable. It's the same cable, but it's now measured differently. And a few people had to go back and redesign their cables because they wouldn't meet the 5E spec. Then we get to category 6. Now, here's the interesting thing. When you go from 100 megahertz to 250 megahertz, which is what this is, the reason you're doing this is to make the boxes at the ends cheaper. Because when you have more bandwidth, you have more lanes on the highway, you can get more cars through more easily. This is what they're talking about. The funny thing is, which most people don't know, is that once they brought out Cat 6 cable, nobody who made boxes did anything at all. There are no Cat 6 boxes. There are no Cat 6 drivers or receivers. They never existed. Nobody ever made them. So lots of people put in Cat 6 cable now for stuff, which is higher bandwidth and better performance. And you know, there are lots of things that are nice about it. But the things that's actually running down is still that Cat 5 box kind of stuff until we get to 10 gig. Yes?
5B and 6 are shielded, aren't they?
What's that?
Cat 5B and 6 are shielded?
No, no. These are all unshielded. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can get shielded versions if you want shielded versions. And that's the thing. We can talk about shielding versus unshielding. And we actually have some shielded and unshielded samples here to show you. And if you're in Europe, they are major shielded. But I think that's mostly paranoia. You know, they're scared that the airplane will crash or the pacemaker will stop working because the unshielded cable will radiate or something. And none of these things have ever happened. We live in an unshielded world over here in the U.S., and Europe is conflicted because half of it's shielded and half of it's unshielded, and nobody cares. So, but these are all unshielded, I'm showing you here. If there was a shield, you would probably, I'd try to show you the shield. This is just four pairs. And the point is, by the time you get to 250 megahertz and Category 6, the specs are different. The standards are different. And that's one of the things which people don't realize is that the 568 committee has a list of specifications. Here's the crosstalk, here's attenuation, here's this and that and this. They don't care how you get there. If you could do this on a Dixie cup and a string, they'd be perfectly happy. So the point is, how people get to those numbers is completely non-standard. And that's why if you look at some of these cables and you compare them and say, well, look at this one's completely different than that one. Yeah, there's no standard as to how you build the cable. It's just getting to numbers, getting to those specs.
Do the specs specify durability?
No. Okay. No. Although you can buy, you know, factory floor durable versions of these or, you know, tactical cables. Yes?
Do they specify connector types?
Nope, just performance. And that's the interesting thing. So if you could figure out how to get there, I mean, obviously, if you're going to plug it into a box that exists and that has an RJ45, then that's the plug you're going to abuse. So you don't have any choice there. So the question is, that's a good question because the RJ45 started in 1960 as a T1 connector, you know, 1.544 megabits. And now suddenly we're at 250 megabits or 1,000, a gigabit, you know? And we're putting it through this, you know, it's like taking your Ferrari to Big O tires, you know? I'm like, oh, I'm not sure if this would work on the racetrack. Maybe going to the supermarket's okay. Yes?
Flat cable, I mean, basically, if you could do a flat cable, then the spec, even though it's not.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, that's the thing. That one on the left is not round. It's kind of a crescent shape, and we have some of it here. This was one of our breakthroughs in 1995. It's almost 20 years old now. I guess you can pass this around. And the point is, what it does is spread the pairs apart by putting them each in their own channel, because that's how you get to the crosstalk. The other way to get to the crosstalk numbers is put something in between the pairs. You see the one on the right, you can clearly see that divider in there, which is pushing the pairs apart. That's to get to these new crosstalk numbers required by Category 6. Yes?
At some point, they changed the spec for the gauge of the wire, right?
No, they never did. Again, it's just what works. And I'll be honest to say that we were the people who started this gauge size thing, and I'm very sorry about it, except what we realized was larger wire is lower resistance, which will go farther and lower loss. And so we said, well, how big a wire will actually fit into the connector? And that's where we hit upon 23 gauge, which is a weird gauge. It didn't even exist before we tried this. And since we draw our own cable, we could draw our own 23 gauge wire as well. And so we started making 23 gauge. Now suddenly everybody's making 23 gauge. But there's nothing in the spec that says it has to be any gauge. It just has to have this attenuation and crosstalk.
Likewise, was there a spec similar expectation of crimping versus soldering and other ways of attaching?
Oh, I don't think they care how you connect it as long as it works. The thing is that crimping has been shown over and over again to be a much better way of making a connection unless you could figure out a better way of making a connection. And that's one of the things that I was just thinking before I was talking here, is that, you know, what's a perfect cable? A perfect cable is one where the connector has disappeared. There is no connector, you know? It's just, you know, continuous cable. Just happens there's a thing in the middle, but you can't see it. It doesn't do anything, and the signal goes right through. That's much harder to do than you think it is, which is why the connector is one of the major places where failure occurs, simply because it's not as good as the cable.
Do you have a terabit cable?
Not yet. We're getting close.
How far away are you from fiber?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we're also talking about distances as well. And if you're talking about long distances, you're going to be in fiber. This is all 100 meters kind of stuff. We currently do, which is 10 gig. This is our current top of the line, 10 gigabits per second. Now we're working on the next one called Category 8, which is going to be 40 gigabits. I haven't seen any, but it's going to be individually shielded pairs, which is kind of like this. This is stuff from Europe. This has all sorts of shields on it, and this is actually Category 7 from Europe, which you can't see inside, but individually shielded pairs. There's no connector that we're even aware of that you can put on this. This is only for punch down. That's the thing. This is a problem here, is how do you connect those individual shields, you know, and isolate them, or do you just combine them, in which case you might as well have had an overall shield to begin with, you know? So this is where we're headed. And Category 8, which I have yet to see, is going to be much closer to this. Hey, if you figure out how to do this, you're the world's first trillionaire, okay? Well, that's the thing. I mean, we're probably coming to the end of copper. We're not quite there yet, but definitely the writing's on the wall. I mean, I work in video as well, and we're coming to the end there as well, although people think the end has already arrived, and I'm going, no, we're not there yet. We still have some life in copper, but yeah. Okay, eventually.
Everybody wants to transmit video with this stuff. It's really important because there's a lot of money.
Well, duh. Right? Of course. It's all about money. Yeah. So, here, I'll pass these around so you can play with these. And you guys are touchy-feely guys and gals. So. Yes. No, I don't think so. Well, can you read a part number on that? If it's 1872, that's solid. 1872, 1874. Solid conductor.
So what's the gauge that it's solid?
23. That was the first cable that we made 23. That was the largest wire we could fit into the connector we were using at the time. That's precisely why. I mean, we also made specials for people that were 22 gauge, but I don't know who made those connectors, I'll tell you that. And it didn't last very long because it's just too huge, you know. And that's the problem, is size versus, you know. I mean, you have to put a connector on. I don't have to. You have to, you know. He has to, you know. I just get to make the stuff.
Basically, this set that you have right now on the 1872, we're back to the, because it's solid core.
Yes.
The issue is not the inflexibility and careful head, basically bend once and stop.
No. You could bend that 2,000 times before it breaks. That what you don't realize is that you're thinking 1950 thoughts. When they didn't know how to anneal cable, or they didn't even anneal it, which is put it back in the oven to make it okay. Now we've known how to do that for a long, long time, and the whole point of flexing and breaking is a non-issue. In fact, I'll bet you, I could give you 10 minutes to try and stop that cable by doing this, and you couldn't do it. Or it's crappy cables from China where they don't anneal. I could show you some stuff that would just curl your hair about how these cables can be bent and still work.
I've seen it.
Well, hey, we have stuff. Let's do it. Just do it today. Let's do it here. We'll take some cables, tighten a knot, look at
it. Tie wraps. What about tie wraps, evenly spaced cables?
Now, see, you're getting me off the subject here, but...
That's what
No, that's a real problem, which is why certainly in the data world they've gone to Velcro ties almost entirely. And in the video world as well, I have a major talk about that, which is you put ties at exactly the same distance and you've picked a wavelength, a frequency, and you can see that in all the harmonics. You can kill your line with wire ties very easily. Yeah, absolutely.
It's just sort of the reality of some of the data.
It is, and it's about getting higher and higher frequency. When you were back at analog video or 16 megahertz bandwidth data, nothing mattered. The wavelengths were so long, you could do anything, and it all worked okay.
So are these Cat 6, Cat 7, Cat 8 cables?
Yes.
Are these impacted the same way or even worse?
Worse, because the wavelengths are shorter and shorter and shorter in the data, which means anything you do that's wavelength related will show up more and more.
What's the bandwidth on these again?
Well, Cat 6 is 250 megahertz. Cat 6A, which is the... Oh, that's what he's carrying. Cat 6A, that's 500 megahertz is the standard. Our cables will go up to 625 megahertz, but the standard says 500 megahertz. That's also Cat 6A, believe it or not, out of Europe. Not available here. Good luck. Okay. Okay. I'm running out of time here, so. There's our first version of Cat 6A. And the thing about Cat 6A, which is very interesting, first of all, 10 gig cable, you know, 500 megahertz per pair. Our cable will do 625 megahertz, but the standard says 500 megahertz. And the whole point is, you'll notice it has that divider in it now to push the pairs apart. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the blue cable and this yellow cable, I'll pass them both out. You look closely at the divider in these, it's completely unlike any other divider that you've ever seen because it's more, in fact, I can show you a better picture up here. Hold on a second. I don't know if you can see that very well, but, oh, I can have an even better picture. That's what it looks like inside. Looks almost like an H. You see those two H's? Because what's happening is that when you have two cables at 10 gig, those frequencies are so high, 500 megahertz, that the cables see the cables next to it. And the pair that's twisted a specific way sees its identical pair in the next cable. This is called alien crosstalk. And that's what kills 10 gig. Is cables looking at other cables, not the crosstalk between the four pairs. So this thing actually divides the four pairs, and it prevents the cables from getting too close to each other. That's why the ends of the H's, you can actually see on the outside of the jacket, you know, this is the world's ugliest cable, by design, to keep the other cables away. And this is why this is unshielded and still works at 10 gig. Most 10 gig out there is shielded for this very reason, that they can't get the interaction between the cables to stop, so they simply put a shield around it. And that's fine, except what that does is increase the crosstalk inside the cable because it doesn't let any energy outside of the cable, and so the crosstalk gets worse and worse inside the cable. And one other thing we've done here, which is kind of clever, there are a bunch of patents you're looking at here, is you notice they're not on the same level, the two pairs are farther away than the other two pairs. So we can pick the pairs that are most likely to talk to each other within the bundle and move those farther apart as well. So I'll tell you, if you think this is easy, hey, go ahead and make this in your garage, you know, no problem. Yeah, this is really, really hard to do.
I still see through all the generations of these, it's four twisted pairs. How are you getting the increased bandwidth?
Just because the cable is better performance. There are new specs that we have to meet.
23 gauge.
Well, 23 gauge is one of the tricks that we can use to get...
The twisting is more twist per inch also.
Now, see, we're going to talk about twisting in the next section. So I'm saving all my twisting talk. You know, we'll twist the night away.
But doesn't the insulation make a difference?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Speed?
Absolutely.
So it's insulation, not the copper?
Well, it's both. But the insulation is really, when you think about it, when you put a signal down a copper wire, it turns into a magnetic field. That magnetic field is in the plastic. So the plastic is very, very specific about how well that cable will work, and the kinds of plastic that we use on these wires is very specific. Some of them are foamed. In other words, they have air in them because that's a better dielectric than the plastic itself. And the point is, where do we go from here, you know? And there's also the precision of how we do this because, you know, each of these pairs has to be very, very precisely built or else the impedance will be wrong and you'll have reflections and you could... And which is why back in the old days, I'm going to start talking about twisting pairs. We'll get to twisted pairs in a minute.
So Steve, one question. On this slide, you have both braiding as well as individuals.
Yeah.
And a brain wire.
Yeah. I call that European paranoia.
But it's Belden, though.
Oh, yes, Belden, Europe. Yeah. And eventually, you could buy it here. Eventually, we're going to have this international catalog, if I have my wish. And you could just look in the catalog, and it says, so this one's made in Europe, so what? Who cares? I want 1,000,000 feet of that. Here it comes.
How critical is it for an overkill?
Depends on what you're trying to do. I mean, these are really intended for things like industrial applications, where it might be, you know, yeah, then we're talking about ruggedness and, you know, flexibility and things like that as well. So, actually, I think we're probably at a good place to segue into the twisting story. Shall I start talking about twisting? Because I have a story about twisting. That's the thing. Everybody says they understand that these pairs are twisted. You do understand that all four pairs are twisted differently. How do you get to those numbers? Well, here's a fantastic story. Back in the days of Category 3, this is the beginning of time, okay? Category 3. AT&T, who was the big mommy of these kinds of cables, decided what they would do, instead of doing the way we had always done it, which is twist and measure and twist and measure and twist and measure and twist and measure, and after 6 months of that, or whenever you're sick and tired of it, you stop, you look at the best numbers you got, and you use those four numbers. Now, they said, no, that's you know, dark ages. We'll do it the real way. And what they did was rent a cray. And they put all the information into the cray. This is Category 3, 16 megahertz. It took 2 weeks on a cray. That was $10 million to generate four numbers. And the funny thing is, how do you patent a number? You know? Well, you don't. And so the funny thing is, after they brought out their four numbered, you know, Category 3, everybody else's Category 3 kind of looked the same as that, you know? It's like, what a coincidence. And the problem is, then along came Category 4 and then Category 5, and by Category 5 at 100 megahertz, there is no computer on Earth, even today, that could calculate that the reactions are so complex. There's no computer that would tell you what the four twist ratios, what the optimal twist ratios would be. So guess what? We twist and we measure and we twist and we measure. We're back to the old way, and we have no other way of doing it. If you could figure out a way to generate those four numbers would easily be worth $1 billion if you could generate those four numbers. So, and then somehow keep it to yourself, exactly. You know? Okay.
Okay, so this here is a look at twist rates in cables, and all of these cables and others are over on the table in plastic bags that you can look at and compare them for yourself. So the twist rates on these wires are different from pair to pair in order to minimize the crosstalk, and the question came up: are the colors twisted the same on different manufacturers' wires? Because the connectors, you wire the same, you wire them by color. So the connectors are always wired the same. But if the pairs are differently twisted, is that going to change anything? So I went and looked at different pairs. This is a Monoprice Cat5e that I cut apart. And on all of these, I eyeballed them and arranged them so that the tighter twist is at the top and the lesser twist is at the bottom, and then I kind of guessed in between. And it's not a precise science. You can decide it yourself. I didn't go and measure, but I put a scale in here so that you could see. So there's one. So the orange is the tightest and the blue is the worst. Here's a general cable, and the blue is the tightest and the brown is the least tight.
Yeah, orange. Yeah.
What?
That looks more like orange at the bottom.
I think this is brown. This is orange.
Oh, okay.
Well, sorry. I guess that's the difference in the screen. You're going to have to rely on me for the colors then.
Yeah, that's fine.
Obviously. So it's blue, green, orange, brown. And we'll go to the next one. And this is a GEPCO enhanced Cat 6, and it's orange, brown, green, blue. And some of these are pretty close calls, and if you look at it tomorrow, you would say, oh no, this is backwards, but this is a general thing. So here's orange, brown, green, blue on this general cable.
And the twist ratio seems different for each cable, too.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. There's no spec for it. It's you meet these numbers, and whatever you do, if you could make it do it with straight wires, then knock yourself out.
Here's a GEPCO, and it looks like blue, green, brown, orange. It's doubtful. You could go either way on that one. The brown looks like it could be lesser. But
do they specify what these twist ratios are?
No. In fact, it's secret. In fact, nobody will tell you what they are.
Here's a Panduit that's orange, brown, green, blue, maybe. Although those are pretty close. Those look pretty... I had a hard time telling. And here's a Belden Brilliance, which we are going to mess with. It's a green jacketed cable. And this is orange, brown, blue, green.
Let me talk about this one for just a second.
Okay.
The interesting thing is this is a low skew cable, meaning it's intended for running video, RGB or VGA or something like that.
Oh, good.
And so the delivery of the four pairs is very, very close to each other. There's very low skew is what that's called. And the way we do that, of course, is playing with the twist ratios. So the twist ratios here are probably closer than they normally would be in our regular cables, but you get this other thing instead. So this is the problem of making cables, is you have this kind of reaction. Plus, we might even change the amount of insulation on the wires to slow down or speed up a signal so that they come in on time even though the twist ratios are different. You think about that, you know, you're doing one thing that goes this way and you want to go the other way. And it gets really complicated.
And I also heard about for video and low skew applications that the twist rates varies over distance per pair. Is that true?
It can.
So we're looking at a specific point in the cable, and this is in this order.
Yeah.
Some other point in the length of the cable would be a completely different
order.
Absolutely. Okay. So there you go on that.
What if you plug it into the Ethernet port?
Well, this actually will run Ethernet. That's the whole point. We're trying to pick, you know, the midpoint so it runs Ethernet okay, but it also runs RGB okay. The thing is, we also make cables that run RGB great that fail in Ethernet because they're intended only to run video. You know, and of course you could run perfect Ethernet and the video wouldn't be so great. This is running video directly on the four pairs, you understand, not video as Ethernet.
But it's analog video, which is...
I'm sorry?
It's analog video.
Yes, this is analog video running on four pairs of wire.
Which is going away.
Hey, yeah, like analog?
No, I know.
Like analog? Like analog?
I know.
I think by the time it's gone, you and I will be long gone.
Well, this computer will be obsolete in 5 years, and I assume the projector may be too, so.
Well, yeah, but you think... You think there won't be a VGA output? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, right. And I think that's the end of the twisted discussion here.
Okay. So. Oh, I should mention one other thing, which is, think about this. You know, you twist, you measure, you twist, you measure, and then you pick your best four numbers. And the problem with that is then you have to have really accurate ways of measuring the twisting so you can go back and reproduce what you did before or else you can't do anything. And so every company does this, and we, you know, I have something I've never been allowed to see, which I call the twistometer, you know, which precisely measures the length of the twist, something called the lay length of the cables, so that we can go back and reproduce it later on when we make the cable, you know, after years of doing this research. Yes?
So, general question, is there any spec on when you have an excess length of cable? Do you coil it? Did you coil it at what radius? Or do you lay it out straight? Or does it matter?
I will tell you this. It's very, very simple. The more random the cables, the better they work. If you put them in a shape like this, this is a deadly shape. That's a deadly shape. And we're going to look at this later. That's why it's done this way. I mean, when you think about this, this is a giant inductor, right? So you're already creating, you know, half of a transformer here with this cable. And, you know, will this show up? Probably. How much? Depends on how good the cable is, you know. But, yeah, this is bad. bad stuff.
And then I think Belden is doing a different set of cables for analog versus digital as well, right?
Well, sure. I mean, we make 6,000 kinds of cable.
Are there specific characteristics you're going to address today? Or?
No. Well, no. In terms of the data cables, this is pretty much it. Although, I could talk about using these cables to run analog signals themselves directly. And is this okay? Can I take a side trip here?
Yeah.
Where? Oh.
Here, let me change you over. Oh, are you on your projector?
No. This is just a box. It's not even produced by Belden. It's by a company called ETS down in Fremont, California. It has four audio connectors here, and the middle connector is an RJ45. And all it does is take the four balanced line pairs and feed them into four balanced line pairs in the middle. And so you just take any kind of data cable, the better the better, and you plug it in, and you plug one in the other end, and you have four audio connections, analog or digital. If it's digital, you have eight, actually, because you can do two channels per pair. And if you use an unshielded cable, then pin one isn't doing anything, so you can't do phantom power. If you plug in a shielded cable that enables pin one, you can do phantom power and stuff like that. So, and this is just using, see, what's inside here? Well, there's nothing. There's nothing inside, just wire. Although it's heavy. I call that marketing. You know, it's like, must be something inside. All these transformers just have, no, nothing inside.
Marketeering.
But aren't the Ethernet connectors, don't they have built-in transformers in there?
No.
Nothing.
Nope.
Huh. Okay.
Just wire.
Mac has a comment.
There are a couple of outfits that make a similar thing that does have really wretched little transformers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
If you ever see one, make sure you stay below minus 20, nothing below 100 hertz because it will saturate.
Yeah, exactly. Now, see, there's nothing in here to saturate, just wire. I mean, the funny thing is, this company sold like one a month. Nobody knew what this was until Obama got inaugurated the first time, and there were hundreds of these running. All the audio you heard worldwide was running through these boxes. And so now they're selling one an hour.
Now they do this for video and so on and so forth.
Well, no, video would be different because that would require a transformer to go from 75 ohms to 100 ohms. This is analog or digital audio, in which case the 100 ohm pairs of the data pairs is close enough to the digital 110 ohms, it works just fine, and in analog, it doesn't matter. Yes?
And there's an industry standard device called a Balun or a Balun.
Yeah. Balun.
And they're designed to go back and forth between cables and other types.
Yeah, from coax to twisted pairs and stuff like that.
You just keep it, it's a twisted pair to a twisted pair. We've got 4 9451.
No, this is better than any. This is better than any twisted pair we've ever made, actually.
On the back side of that XLR, you just tie into one of these pairs.
Yeah.
Efficient use of the cable.
Yeah. The only problem, of course, it comes four pairs to a bundle, you know, which is why this is one of the first products I brought out as product line manager. One pair data cable. They were going to shoot me. They said, "Who's going to buy that? Nobody's going to buy one pair data cable. That doesn't make any sense at all. We can't make it fast enough now." So everybody at Belden who said that before is now angry, you see. You didn't tell me. Yes, I did. This is the world's best audio cable, is what this is. It's also the physically quietest cable we've ever made. That's just one pair Cat5e stranded patch cable. It's nothing special. It's a bonded pair, so it's really quiet. That's all. Unshielded.
Unshielded.
Simple.
And what do you use it for?
Audio.
For
anything you want. As long as it's not phantom power or something like that, it'll run audio. And it's tiny and comes in different colors.
And it's three wires into the ground?
No, there's no ground, no shield.
Oh, it is.
Just a twisted pair. One twisted pair.
I'd like to get a clarification for the group about a comment that Dan made earlier when we first got on the topic.
Yes.
Dan had mentioned that various manufacturers use different colors for the different twist ratios, and I just wanted to get a clarification for all of us that in the long run, does that or does not that have any significance?
It's not supposed to have a significance. That the colors are part of the standard. But the standard doesn't say which one is the tightest or the loosest or, you know, what the crosstalk between the pairs is supposed to be. It just says, here are the crosstalk requirements for the whole cable. And
I understand
so,
that, but when Dan mentioned it, you know, he kind of mentioned it in the form of a question. And the question never got answered, so I just wanted it to be covered.
Yeah. I mean, certainly you can make good cable and you can make bad cable. And it's very clear. And that's one of the things when we get into the plugging it in today, hopefully we'll see some difference between good and bad. And it's not hard to make bad cable.
The question came up in the course of a discussion that I read on a forum about wiring a connector and looking at this standard here. We're pretty much always on 568B, it seems. And
yeah, which is the AT&T standard, by the way.
Okay.
They rule the world.
And the orange color is this pair, the blue color is this pair, the brown color is this pair, and the green
is split.
Color is split. So there's a space in the wires. Those wires are farther apart. And if I understood the discussion correctly, it was what happens when you have the tight pair as the far apart one versus the loose pair, and how does that compare to these other guys where the split is not necessary in the wires is not necessarily as far apart. So at high bit rates, something changes. There.
Yes, and this is a huge problem. The reason why we have this, and in fact, there's a split pair in A as well. You know, it's just a different pair that's split.
Different pair.
But the whole point is this was to make it backward compatible to the telephone, believe it or not.
That's the only reason.
That's the only reason.
That was a big reason when it was done.
Well, yes. In 1970, that's a huge reason. So don't mess with that, you see. But, yeah, because of that, we're now paying the price. Although you look at, like, a Category 6, this is a 10-gig patch cable here, which I'll pass out. Look at the twists inside here, and you realize one of the things is that we've done all we can do to push the twists all the way to the end of the connector before they're split and moved, you know? And the whole point is because the less distance it spins apart, the better it works.
So if the reason you do the split pairs is for compatibility.
Correct.
Not performance.
No.
And the twist, what?
No, it goes against performance. In fact, there is a standard of where all four pairs are just in line called USOC, and nobody uses it.
Right. So it doesn't matter which pair is twisted tighter.
Well, it does after this.
After this? Yes.
Yeah.
But I mean,
This is definitely a major problem along the as you get out, as you leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think you brought up a question I was going to ask. Is Belden involved in making connectors? The question of how far it's untwisted before you terminate is critical.
Absolutely.
Connectors, you've done this quite a bit.
Absolutely.
And that's getting into our next subject.
I was going
to
say,
I think this is a good time.
You want
to
jump in, Kurt, any time here.
Yeah, Kurt, come on up front and let's get you going here. So Steve, give him your headset, and we'll get his laptop wired up.
Are you thinking, are we talking about test gear, or are we talking about
We're talking connectors and terminations.
Okay.
So connectors and so forth. So once you get that on, and we didn't practice that. Turn it the other way around. It's upside down. There you go.
Oh, there we go.
Goes over your ear.
So, yeah, the, what
and
you see.
We got to move the cable here.
What's that?
So, importance-wise, which is more important? Is the twisting pairs are cross-talking to one another problem or outside interference causing
I am almost ready. Blasted windows.
It's the same thing you're talking about.
If I'm doing like an inline connector,
yes.
Is there any way to just shield that connector for you? That connector is maybe the loose pair.
Yeah, but how are you going to terminate the shield?
Well, I'm just mechanically just like drawing off or shielding it from outside CMF coming from the tower, you know, a block away or something.
You really need to have some way of
clamshell, steel, or iron, something. now silly thing.
A lot of work to do something that could be done by good controlling of the pairs through the connector. Well, that's the point. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, there is no simple solution to that problem. I mean, yeah, I guess you could shield it, but I would say really to have a perfect shield, you have to be able to have a drain wire going somewhere that drains away the energy that shield has collected, or else it will simply be an antenna to pick stuff up and feed it into the pairs. It could be worse. In fact, the funny thing is, and a lot of factory installations, we have solved more problems by going to unshielded twisted pairs rather than shielded twisted pairs, because the shields have to work correctly too. And if you don't hook them together, if you have a ground loop or some shield imperfection, it turns into an antenna very, very quickly and actually exacerbates the problem.
Although, to add to that, I was talking to some people back at Belden Engineering last month, and it turns out that for some of the Cat 6A patch cord stocks, they actually have a shield which is not intended to be terminated.
Yeah, a passive shield.
And so there the thing is just acting as a kind of a reflector and absorber and attenuator of noise going into the cable.
That's my invention.
Is it?
Yeah, you should have patented it, see?
The trick always, when we're talking about termination on Cat 6, is as was mentioned, you've got a problem of controlling how much untwist you've got. And the difficulty is that most of the Cat 5 type connectors that you see out there are intended for a kind of a quick and easy get your wires in order, clench them all between your thumb and forefinger and shove them into the back of the connector. And the problem with that is right there you've got too much untwist length for doing a reliable Cat 6 termination. So what you want to have is some means of carrying the twists forward into the cable.
Yeah, can
and
you hold it up to the camera?
I'm sorry, where are you?
Turn sideways.
Yeah. Yeah, so now I've got this patch cable opened up. There's a spline down the middle. We just take that thing out of there. Now there's quite a bit of untwisting involved. And what I always say to people at this point, you want to be thinking already about how these pairs are going to go in the connector. Here's my orange, here's my blue, here's my green, and here's my brown. I want to be holding this thing so that I see the orange on the left and the brown on the right, which is where I'm going to need to put this. And as I get these untwisted, I want to be mindful. I'm untwisting, of course, here quite a bit more cable than it will actually go in, because it's just usually convenient to do this. But you want to be mindful of where you want your twist to wind up in the connector as you're untwisting. And you want to hold this back here so that you're not propagating this untwist back under the cable jacket. And basically get these things lined up in such a way that you're going to have your conductors fall naturally into the order that you want them to fall into. Now the usual, there are a bunch of different connectors out there. And obviously they've all got different termination instructions. But the ones that we've found that we really like, and we've had very good test results with, are from a company called Sentinel. They're made in York, Pennsylvania, which is an unusual thing. Right? You don't see a lot of connector manufacturers, especially for something as cheap as an RJ45, operating in the US any longer. But by whatever means, they're able to do it. And they've got a ridiculously large product catalog with connectors specialized for a variety of different cable stocks. Right here, this is one of these Belden bonded pair cables. So I'm just using the Belden bonded pair tool, which you probably really can't make out too well there, but to split the green pair, since that's got to come apart. And that gets split all the way back.
I'd be glad to send you one.
And this, well, boy, there's no way you're going to see that very well on the screen, but there's a little black plastic piece here, which is a load bar intended to go on this cable. This particular connector actually has an A version and a B version, because one of the classic problems of cable termination is that while the pairs appear in this radial order on this end of the cable, they of course appear in the opposite radial order on the opposite end of the cable. And if you make just one connector, then one side or the other of this is going to be more awkward to wrench around. This little load bar.
No, I can't.
This little baby sleeves on to your conductors. In this case, it's open on the sides, and so what I'm able to do is just feed it the green and the blue pairs initially. And this is all a good deal more fiddly and time-consuming than it is when you're dealing with a more conventional Cat5 connector. But what you'll find is that if you are running the things on the tester, this will actually get you a compliant result, where the other won't. These last pairs just actually socket into this load bar from the side. Now all that excess wire can go. And we've got this thing right back where it needs to be. Now, dimensional control on these things is pretty tight, and one of the problems that creates is that the good connectors will typically have a kind of a narrow socket that these wires have to hit. And so just a little bit of unwanted twist in the pairs or poor spacing between the conductors will sometimes cause this not to work. So you want to chase all that out of the system as much as you can. And here, in this case, as I said, this one has a two-sided system. There's what they call the green up and the green down side of the connector. Make sure I'm using the right one here. Yep. And if you've done all this right, which, miracle of miracles, performance anxiety and everything else aside, I have actually done, it goes right in there. Now what you've got is the untwist really doesn't begin until right in back of that load bar, because you've shoved that load bar down hard onto the open end of the cable. It allows you to get a crimp on the jacket, and now you've got a good solid connection. And now you've got my tester up. This is where I get to fail.
So you already terminated the other end of it?
Yeah, the other end of it I terminated earlier, so assuming nothing has gone awry here, Murphy's Law and all that, I've got to reset this fella.
And this is one of these awesome Fluke DTX 1800 cable testers that tests a zillion parameters, and we'll get into that in a little while here. But you'll see in a second here, it gives you a pass or fail.
So now you're seeing the display screen. We switch this over and hit the test button, and it's going to actually give us back a little report. Ooh, it's a marginal pass. That's what the little asterisk there means. So I probably didn't do as good a job as I ought to have on that end. You can see it's giving me some pass margins here. It's doing great on return loss. That's 7.1 dB is the worst margin in the cable over the required return loss numbers. But the near end crosstalk is passing by only half a dB in this case.
Misses as good as a mile.
And this'll get you there. Usually we do better on the clearance. But what in all likelihood, if you look at this near-end crosstalk, this is going to show you exactly the kind of thing. Yep, look at that. That's the worst pair in near-end crosstalk. And look at those pins. That's pair 3, 6, 4, 5. We were just talking about the problem created by making the green pair split rather than having it socket into two adjacent points like the other three pairs. And invariably, no matter how well or how poorly you do these things, you wind up with the worst numbers, typically in crosstalk on the 3, 6, 4, 5, because you've got one pair laid right over another one and splitting on top of it, and there's just a certain amount of unavoidable crosstalk that's going to come from doing that.
When you separate the pair, you change the impedance of the pair, and then the pair starts to radiate, is why this happens. So, but unfortunately, that's the standard.
Does the presence of the load bar increase that distance where it's not twisted?
No, it actually decreases it, because the problem that you have if you don't have a load bar in the connector is that you've got to clamp all these wires in order and shove them into the back of the connector, and that invariably forces you to untwist them to a greater distance. What the load bar is really doing is it's allowing you to shorten that distance up considerably so that you've gone from having maybe 3/4 of an inch to 3/8 of an inch of untwist. And that makes a huge amount of difference. If you do these, if you do Cat 6 cable into standard Cat 5e rated connectors and you just shove it in from a point where your untwist is manageable, you get a lot more failures. You see a lot more failures, particularly on crosstalk. It also messes with the return loss on the green pair, particularly.
Can you take that twisted pair, the green pair?
Yeah.
You untwist like two more twists. It's a little bit further back instead of being right up to the load bar. Slide it a little bit further back. Does that distance improve this crosstalk effect? Because you're no longer directly.
No, it'll make it worse. You want to keep it as close together, not spread it apart.
If you push it too far, then you start to put pressure on that twisted pair. And that shortens that distance of the last twist. Is that shortening of the distance of the last twist causing an impact?
We have seen that, yeah, in some cases. It usually has to be pretty bad, but when we've had bad terminations, you'll be looking and you'll see here comes your green pair. It comes out and splits, and maybe somebody had a little trouble jamming this into the connector, and so one of the greens goes down a little bit, takes a sharp kink, takes another sharp kink to go back up, and then that'll make all kinds of havoc. And you look at it and you say, this is an incredibly minor defect, and you cannot believe that it's causing the cable to fail testing, but in fact it is. So yeah, ideally you want a fairly smooth split. You don't want it to be extremely abrupt. But obviously you also don't want it to be very long, and so it's a little bit of a balance between those. Primarily, you don't want it to be very long.
Is this category 6 you're looking at?
This is Cat 6, yes.
That's the thing. 5E is very easy. You could easily do that yourself. 6 is considerably harder, and 6A is extremely hard. And Cat 8, don't even talk about it.
Yes?
Using the load bar on Cat 5E as opposed to
It yeah. will indeed, yeah. Yeah. So we actually use them on everything we do. And frankly, you know, once you get used to the routine, a little different routine in terms of loading the connector up, it's not even particularly more time consuming. It's actually kind of liberating. And in fact, on Cat 5e, it's downright easy because the twist rates are so low that it takes you a lot less prep work to get the cable into the load bar. It's when you get into the 6A and things like that, the stuff that's incredibly tightly twisted, it actually takes quite a bit of energy just to end prep the cable. Yes?
The solid wire construction that you have in Melbourne, when you use a crimp-style connector, does the contact resistance change versus a stranded wire? How can you use this kind of connector?
You can use stranded wire. You have to be a little more careful to keep the strands together.
No, I'm saying the solid.
Solid is better than stranded, if that's what you're asking.
No, because the connector that I forgot your name, that you just made, it's like a knife that goes through the wire, right? That makes the contact.
Yeah.
So in a stranded wire, it's easier for that to travel between the strands.
that there's a solid wire, but there's just only one wire. Is there a burn in each of the...
Yeah, but it's not true. The solid is still better. And mainly it's because the dimensions of that wire are very clear and don't change, where the stranded wire can move around and change its shape, and which is what it's intended to do.
No, my question is, when, as far as the connection of a solid wire to each of the blades of the connector,
yes,
versus a stranded wire to each of the blades of the connector.
I guess there might be a slight difference in resistance. The strands would conform to
right.
give better surface area, but the fact that they've changed their shape to do this means you've changed that the return loss, the impedance. So you've won and you've lost at the same time.
So some connector manufacturers specify that their connectors are, they'll have a connector stranded and a connector solid.
Right, that's
and
what
it's meant to be.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
That's exactly what
yeah. Have you done stranded on these same connectors?
Actually, we haven't. We've been meaning to. Have not done it.
Are they specified for either?
They are specified for either. There's no specification on that.
It seems like they're all universal now.
So. Yeah.
Well, I guarantee you that the stranded cables, they have their own spec because they're so much worse than the solid cables.
Right.
They're patch cables. They're not intended to go very far. And this part of the problem is that now we make tactical patch cables, which he has a 200-footer that he brought with him, that stranded conductors, and now you're running hundreds of feet on stranded conductors, which was never intended. But hey, let's plug it in and see what it looks like, because that's what people, for like rolling the Ethernet snakes and stuff like that, they want this super rugged, stranded, flexible, like mic cable kind of stuff. You can't have both worlds, it's either stiff and beautiful, or it's flexible and not so good.
Oh, and Dan had mentioned shielded connectors also. I've actually looked at a lot of different shielded connectors. I haven't brought any with me here to show you termination on those. What I can tell you is what most of them will have you do is fold back some of the foil over the cable jacket and crimp that along with the drain wire underneath the rear entry into the connector. And that, frankly, it's a really cheesy way to attach a shield. It's not very mechanically reliable. Since when we're dealing with it, we're dealing with patch cords. And, of course, with a patch cord, you're always thinking about insertion and removal and what's going to happen after people flex this and tug on it and so on. My reaction to the way that most of the shielded connectors work is it just isn't very good. And what we prefer to do, if we have to do them, is to get out the soldering iron, just run the drain wire out the back of the connector and tick it onto the shell with a little bit of solder, and you have a much more durable connection. Put a little heat shrink over it if you can, and call that good. Because boy, these crimp down kind of connections, it's a case of a connector that was never intended to be used shielded, having had a shield applied to it, and there's really nowhere to put it, and consequently no single consistent good way to attach them.
The shield continuity in the jack, between the jack and the plug, is horrible. Anyway, I did a bunch of just ohmic tests on different manufacturers' chassis mount connectors, and they're all over the map.
Do you guys have a product like a solder sleeve to do the shields easier, or have you looked at the impact of solder sleeves on shielding?
No, that's not something I'm familiar with. In fact, so far we haven't done shielded. The only shielded stuff we do currently is we have a Belden patch cord stock, which has one of those unconnected shields, which I mentioned earlier, that there's no drain wire and it's not intended to be terminated. So we just terminate that like a regular unshielded cable. Haven't seen a lot of demand for shielded cable, although frankly, a lot of our business is in the consumer market, and we kind of expect that we will, because there are a lot of people in that market who believe shields are magic, and so shielded cable has got to be better than unshielded cable because it's got a shield.
So we have a couple of shielded cables here, at least. Aren't these shielded connectors?
This is
one you did?
This is one. This is Belden 2412F.
We'll pass these around.
And what we've got here is, boy, you really can't make out much on there.
Yeah.
But what I've done is to just go ahead and solder that onto this back clip. A lot of these, they'll have a clamp coming out the back side of the connector, and you just roughly kind of crunch that thing onto the outside of the cable. Again, a really cheesy way to try to attach a shield with any kind of reliability, and really, you know, you're dealing with sheet metal here that falls apart after a few flexes. And so even if you've got good shield engagement the first time around, you sure don't have it after that.
And that's shielded too.
This, yeah, is this monoprice?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen some of these. And yeah, that boot doesn't come off, so you can't tell how this shield's been terminated without a little more destructive testing.
But you can plug it in.
We could plug it in. We could find out. Is that a 6A?
Yeah.
Yeah, they...
Industrially, is there a machine that...
Yeah, well, yeah. That's one reason why until...
Do you know what the length is on this?
Generally, we will not sell you a plug.
Okay.
Because we don't trust how well you can put it on. And, you know, the plugs that you can get are kind of variable in their performance, as you now understand from all of this. But what we do sell you is, I'll sell you a jack, which you can put in a plate, you can put on a wall, you can punch wires on the back of it. That we will trust you to do. The male plug itself, that's an iffy situation. And that's why, you know, Kurt would probably prefer to use our plugs, but we won't sell him any. So, but we'll do these in a factory, in a machine that will do it, which is why when you look at those patch cables I was passing out, you can see the precision, there's a precision here that no human being could do. And that's the problem. You're not about to buy a $25,000 machine to put your connectors on. And we know this. So I'm not exactly sure what to tell you to do. Buy pre-made cables. We also sell pre-made cables as well. And that's why. And certainly by the time you get to 6A, I mean, it gets very, very complicated.
Yeah, it's very easy to do a termination and then find that that you haven't passed.
It
to
looks
my
perfect,
surprise,
yeah.
I found that some of the monoprice stuff is actually reasonably good. If you go around, oh, there we go, fail.
Huh, it didn't fail from my tester.
Well, again, you're using the channel adapters.
So
this is the patch cord standard, and it's missed on return loss pretty badly, and is marginal for crosstalk.
But do the channel.
If you do the channel, it's going to pass. The problem is this isn't a channel. But yeah, if we do the channel, what you're going to wind up...
Yeah, we're going to get into that, I think, in the measurement section, which will be next, I think.
I have a question.
It's confusing.
You had mentioned earlier that nobody was making stuff that accepted Cat 6 on the device end, so why...
Now that we're into 10 gig, that is no longer true. There's 10 gig devices out there. It says Cat 6 as an attempt to make things easier for the networking folks. Nobody ever bought into it on the hardware side. But we still make Cat 6 cable, even though there's no hardware that's Cat 6.
It's very hard to get Cat 6 match
handles. Yeah, for that same reason.
So once again, my question, if you don't have anything to plug it into, why not?
Because it's better than Cat 5e. I mean, you know, it's better tires for the same car you're already driving.
Don't you need Cat 6 for gig networking?
No, Cat 5e is intended for gig as well. That's the E, is for a gig. I mean, the point is, and that's the thing, you think about Cat 6 is 2.5 times the bandwidth, so therefore it's going to make it easier to do a gig, you know? So, I mean, that's the argument. It's better cable, so it'll be easier to do. But there's nothing specific that you're going to plug it into that matches that cable. By the time you get to 6A, augmented 6 for 10 gig, that's completely different. That's all now. There's real 10 gig devices out there.
If you had a long cable, these cables are limited to 100 meters.
100 meters.
If you have a 100-meter cable, is a Cat 6 going to measure and pass data better than a Cat 5e?
Well, it has more
rejection,
margin, more bandwidth, more margin. You know, more headroom.
So that's a reason to use Cat 6.
Yeah.
Right there. As the distance goes out and the number of connections in the channel increases, using a cable with a higher margin makes it easier for it to work?
Correct.
You can't have very many connections.
You can't have more than four. Yeah. Four connections.
It depends on.
That's pushing your load.
Well, yeah, it depends on what you're doing, of course.
Okay. And that is part of the difference between channel and patch cord for these measurement devices. And we're starting to get into the measurement. And link. Okay. Talk about that. Talk about the differences between those three categories.
They're permanently installed stuff in a building is generally regarded as a link. And it will, for data networking, they pretty much will never make a patch cord. You will not find data installers putting mail connectors on in the field, not if they want to pass their certification. So there's a permanent link that is installed in the building, goes jack to jack, patch field to wall jack typically, and that gets tested to full six standards. And so now you know that that's good. Changing a patch cord is easy at that point. When we first started putting in network lighting systems, it was pretty much the Wild West, and we were putting on male RJ45s all over the place in the field. I got pretty good at it. I had better than 90% success ratio. I was pretty happy about that. But putting them on in the field, and I mean in the field, is a pain and not reliable. I got, when the Easy 45s came out, I was quite happy. For every now and again you need one, you know it's not going to make six. You accept that. The stuff we're doing here is not six. It's 100 base. That's all they're using. That said, if I'm doing networking for the company in the building, we run Cat 6 cable in the building. Terminate it. I have the predecessor of this Fluke. Every cable in our building is verified. I don't like problems. I'm a little compulsive about it. I've spent way too much time chasing down network issues.
Well, and, you know, I, when I was in Richmond at the Belden Engineering Center last month, I was talking to an engineer there, Galen Garris, who's involved in a lot of the network cable development there. One of the things that he was saying about that is that it's very important to use high-quality cable in your permanent link installations because you never know who's going to plug what kind of patch cord into it. And his view, he gave an example of University of Miami in Ohio that they had done everything with the Belden bonded pair with the fancy schmancy stuff because the quality of the student's patch cord that goes into a university network could be absolutely anything. They probably, you know, picked it up at Best Buy or in an office supply shop or who knows what. Most of the things just aren't compliant, but the more headroom you've got in the permanent link, the lousier the patch cord can be, and the whole channel still winds up working.
Also, if it's in your building, it's probably going to be in there for 10 years. Things are going to evolve.
And let's get back to the channel versus patch cord versus permanent link.
Okay.
And this came up. This discussion came up because this DTX 1800 has different adapter thingies for those various categories. You can't plug your connector into the device without picking the right one of these.
You can, but it'll complain.
Yeah, and I discovered that the patch cord limitation the patch cord spec is way tighter than the channel spec. It'll reject a lot of stuff. If there's a connection in the patch cord, if there's a jump or a barrel, you can't connect to the patch cord gizmo. It'll say, forget it, this is the wrong thing. You got to do the category,
channel.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, the channel is pretty much the whole thing end to end.
Yes.
Including patch cords, link, more patch cords, however many barrels you put in to jump your two short cables.
And why are there two things? Why is there a channel and why is there a patch cord?
Well, because a patch cord, you want to test, ideally, you want to test to good standards. because it's short. So the window is tighter on that.
By definition, it's
short. By definition, a patch cord is short.
Okay.
And if you put a really, does yours reject, if you put a 100 meter cable on their patch cord adapter, does it complain?
No, it won't complain, but there is a problem with testing very long patch cords, which is that the TIA spec for crosstalk on a patch cord gets tighter as the length of the patch cord goes longer. Fluke has pre-programmed test limits for specific cable lengths into the tester, and the most you can do is 20 meters.
We've got speakers right behind where Steve and Mac have chosen to stand to talk.
It's all right.
I'm
listening for the edge.
Okay.
I can get pretty close.
So when Kurt measured this cable, he first used the patch cord adapters, and it failed. Then he used the channel adapters, and it passed.
And if this cable, assuming you're in an unusual system where that cable is the entire link, then I guess it is the channel, But sure. But that's not going to be a typical installation, at least not if we're in a permanent installation scenario. You're going to have this thing going into a wall jack, which is going to a permanent link, which is probably going to other equipment.
But again, you're not going to use a 100-footer for that purpose. You're going to have a 6-footer or a 20-footer or whatever.
Ordinarily not, but it does depend. Sometimes you just get people who are very lazy in wiring offices.
So then the question comes, what is the correct, this failed one standard and passed another? So which one do I use when I'm measuring my stuff? I want to use the one that it's going to pass.
Well, you want to use the one that represents your application.
Yeah.
And if that is your channel, if both ends of this are terminating into devices, and that's
right.
You're not really running a network, you're running a link.
Right.
Then you can test it under the channel standards, and that should be good enough.
Mm-hmm.
But if this is part of a greater system. It doesn't make spec if it is a patch cord. Now, of course, these specifications are intended to provide some headroom and all, and that means that things will fail and they will work in practice. And for that reason, there are different kinds of testers out there. Fluke also makes this, they call a certification tester. They have something they call a qualification tester, which is more of a rough and ready kind of thing, still expensive, but it sends some data down the cable and it says, did it get there? If it got there, great, this works. That doesn't tell you the thing is spec compliant, and it doesn't tell you it'll work in every environment, but it does tell you that what you got in front of you appears to be working just fine.
Okay.
That kind of an error, does that identify a particular kind of fault, like jitter or skew or some of these other negatives?
Jitter is a function of the transmitter and receiver and how that all works. That's not really cable dependent. Skew definitely is. And they're kind of related because some transmitters or some receivers specifically deal with skew better than others.
I can show you, if we're really sort of segueing into measurement as opposed to other things, I can show you how you can use some of this information diagnostically to tell you what's the matter. And for that purpose, actually, I've built a very bad patch cord. And
for the benefit of the group, it might not be a bad idea to define skew.
Skew, intra-pair skew, is where you've got two wires in a pair that are not the same electrical length. So you've got a differential signal and...
Two pairs.
What's that?
Two pairs that are different.
No, intra-pair skew. Intra-pair skew, two wires of different electrical length in the same pair. So you've got a differential signal. You're relying on these two halves of the differential signal arriving at the same time, and one of them, in fact, is arriving a little earlier than the other. You always have some of that. And then what people are usually talking about with skew is inter-pair skew, which means data is going down one pair at a different speed than down another pair.
And since the pairs are twisted differently, this is absolutely going to happen. But there's some ways we can play with either the amount of insulation on the wire or the size of the wire or various other things to reduce that difference. So we can, even though we don't want to stop them from talking to each other.
That's a good idea.
Exactly.
I've, do you also frequency dependent sometimes? Or is it the speed, I guess, would not be? That would be more impeded.
Shouldn't be.
I don't think it is.
Yeah, in fact, this chunk of media twist I've got is really interesting. So you put it on there, they all come out exactly the same length and are very, very close, and the skew is very, very small.
But you look at the pairs, and clearly they're different. Yeah. So we've been pretty close.
Yeah, there's a lot of engineering on stuff.
So I've built here a very poor patch cord. You can see this termination. I don't know if you can make that out, but the green pair has rabbit ears, which are coming out of the back end of the connector, and this gives you a good opportunity to see just, you know, in a very dramatic way, diagnostically, what's going to happen when you test that, and you say, I have no idea why that won't pass. Naturally enough, what you're going
to
see.
Smoke.
So there's our fail, and it's going to fail, I think, both return loss and. Oh, that's funny. It actually managed to make it on crosstalk. Depending how I move those two wires around, I probably make it fail crosstalk too. But the return loss, you know, you'll see here are the four pairs, and obviously there's one pair that is way out of whack, and you can probably guess which one that is. Now, the thing about it is you can get a result like this when you're measuring, say, a permanent link in a network, and you don't know that somebody has buggered up the installation because that's behind the jack panel. You're not going through and studying all these things. But if you see something like that, you're going to want to start looking for where it is. And the interesting thing here is that if we want to look at the pairs, this device has a TDR function, and it's basically run a TDR trace on each of these pairs. On the left side is the main tester end. On the right side is the remote unit end. And there are your TDR traces. The two red lines represent where the connectors are, and it's, as you can see, obviously there's a gigantic impedance bump at the first connector. The other connector is just fine. You've got all this, you know, low wobbly kind of stuff. People will use this kind of thing in diagnosing a network. If you see that, say you're testing a channel and you find that where that fault occurs is 25 feet down the cable and you're hooked in with a 25-foot patch cord, you're going to be going and examining how the punch down was done on that jack and, of course, checking your patch cord to make sure it isn't the problem, that kind of thing.
What's on
the y-axis? On the y-axis, I'm not actually sure. It's percentage of what, Steve?
Reflection. Yeah.
Oh, all right, sure, yeah. Sure. So it's probably a reflected signal as a percentage of transmitted.
Could it be phase in degrees or?
No, it's just reflection.
Can you wiggle the two green wires?
Yeah, wiggle the wires.
Yeah, if we, let's say we.
But then he has to do another sweep.
Sure. Yeah, I got to run the test again. I've twisted those up into pairs and. And tuck them closer to the cable to see if we can get a little more crosstalk, maybe.
And this is a factor that's going to affect us later. This device is not a dynamic measuring device. Runs a static test. You push a button, and it does its thing, and it spits out a number. It doesn't monitor the cable continuously.
What we actually want to do here
is
if we...
I think it can be. At least fine.
We couldn't figure it out. If you can figure it out, then
mine will do sort of real time. Oh, it keeps testing in your series.
We get really quiet while it's working.
Yeah, we still wind up passing crosstalk, but the crosstalk margin moves around a lot as you manipulate those, because of course they're not really supposed to be out there floating in free space. The return loss, you know, that's basically a function of bad impedance and just having taken those wires, separated them considerably for a distance and all, it messes the impedance of the pair up, in this case for about a length of 2 or 3 inches total on each leg, and that's why it's flunking the return loss so badly.
Can we go to that graph?
What's that? Oh, yes, yes. If we go to...
This is why you don't use a telephone installer to install your data.
So but there, yeah, you see pretty much the same magnitude of result. Maybe a little gentler. People use this diagnostically. You know, from our standpoint, selling cable assemblies, it's very nice because not only do you have the tester tell you that the cable is bad, but it tells you which end. And so you know which connector you probably need to cut off and re-terminate. Fortunately, I can say that once you get used to doing these things, it is actually possible to have consistent success putting Cat6 and 6A connectors on. But there is definitely a much tighter margin for failure on these things. It's not a rough and ready thing like with Cat5e networks, where you can really just install connectors in the field, not test them for anything but continuity, and figure, you know, as long as I didn't do a completely bollocked up job, this ought to work. Yes.
If you don't have the $10,000 for the testing device, can you hook a cable between a couple of computers to see if it'll transmit data?
I don't, you know, of course, yes. What I don't know is you probably need some kind of network diagnostic software to work out what's happening, because one of the things is that some kinds of network devices will just ramp down the data speed in order to cope with the fact that stuff isn't getting through. So the fact that things work doesn't necessarily mean that you're not slowing the network down. What's that?
So, Steve, do you have a comment? Or?
No.
Okay. So we're not quite 2 hours from when we started. How is everybody doing? Do you want to take a break? Do you want to stop for lunch?
What's the next topic?
Measurement systems is the next topic. Fred?
I have a question for you just before we move on. We've talked a lot about the rigor involved in terminating ALRJ45, but what about the jacks? What about in Jack Bay or an installed system that has a... most of those are punch down front.
Yeah.
Correct. Right, as opposed to this really tight crimp.
Right, and I don't know much about that end of things because I sell cable assemblies, but
effect that has on performance.
It's very much the same kind of problem.
Just about the same. I mean, they're both critical. That said, most jack fields are from the major manufacturers now are pretty well set up, and if you follow the directions, they'll pass pretty much every time. I can't remember the last time I've had a jack fail.
Now, so these jacks, they're much easier to handle.
Determined, yeah.
Yeah, they've spent a lot of time figuring out how to make these things idiot-proof.
But
you're still taking off the other jack and
you're
dealing with the pair. Yeah. And I've... You punch them into these slots. So it's not quite the same as the
template. Yeah. And the same thing applies. You want to untwist the minimum possible amount. And most of the jacks now have got a nice channel that you put it in and just bring the wires out.
So it's kind of like a load bar kind of thing.
It's a lot easier than putting a male on.
Yeah, there's a little orange thing here that you preload the cables into, so you can't put the wrong pair in the wrong place.
You'd be amazed what installers will do.
there are all the pairs are at right angles to each other,
yeah.
And this is an attempt to reduce the crosstalk even more. Most jacks have two rows for the four parts, and that means there's a lot of crosstalk between those cables. Now that they're right angles, there's less crosstalk. So that's why it looks a little weird in the back. If you've ever done a jack, this probably looks different than the jack you've done. Yeah?
Just more of a general question. Are there devices that you're talking about the quality of continuity versus the quality of connections, you know, on the patch panel and stuff? Are there any devices that are so
there are certainly bad cables that don't work.
I mean, it depends
you'll find bad, you know. I mean, you're trying to get a cable that won't work.
No, I was asking for other devices that are smart enough to detect this cable is bad and it rejects the cable.
Almost. Most systems, as somebody mentioned, are smart enough that if they're not getting reliable data transmission, they'll actually dial it back. A lot of the switches and stuff like that, if they're getting bad packets, they'll just go slower. Right.
Is it the head end of the thing inside?
Yep.
The seat of your pants thing, if you've got a problem and your diagnostic says your connection card is great, and you're still going to get a problem, yank the cable and replace it if that's the issue.
Yeah. Well, that's when you start getting fancy boxes again.
But it's still only going to happen in the cable side of it, not pop up with side. But yeah, if you're getting the fancy boxes, the normal basis of sitting there in a data center or something like that, where you're trying to look this stuff in the field, you don't have that capability to allow you to see.
A lot of the higher-end managed switches have got extensive diagnostic suites inside them that 99% of the users never, ever see. But as Cisco is infamous for it. They are not user-friendly, but you can go in there and it'll tell you chapter and verse about what the data connection quality to a device looks like. Yeah, they don't make it easy, but it's there. That's typically why the Cisco switches cost about 3 times what anybody else's cost. If you're in a critical situation, it's worth it.
It's almost like you get what you pay for.
Okay, where are we at here? Are we taking a break? Yeah, okay. Do you want to take a 10-minute break? Did you order food? Or are you ready to keep going? Did people order food? Raise your hand if you ordered food. Nobody did. Okay. Do you want to go get food or do you want to keep going? You want to go get food? Okay. Let's call an hour. Thank you.